Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Gregory Gause, who's the Department Chair and Professor of Political Science at the University of Vermont. He's the author of three books, The International Relations of the Persian Gulf, Oil Monarchies, Domestic and Security Challenges in the Arab Gulf States, and Saudi-Yemeni Relations, Domestic Structures and Foreign Influence. Previously, he was a fellow for Arab and Islamic Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gregory Gause.
Thanks, Ian.
And Saudi King Abdullah took to state television on Friday, and just quoting him, "I call on the honest men of Egypt and the Arab and Muslim nations to stand as one man and with our heart in the face of attempts to destabilize a country that is at the forefront of Arab and Muslim history. Let it be known to those who interfere in Egypt's internal affairs that they themselves are fanning the fire of sedition and are promoting the terrorism which they call for fighting." Who is he referring to in terms of the foreign influences interfering in fanning the flames of sedition?
Well, I think he's probably referring primarily to the Muslim Brotherhood. And the Saudis have seen the Brotherhood in Egypt and around the Middle East as a political competitor and an enemy for a number of years now. Not always, but certainly in the last 5 or 6 years, they've identified them as such, and maybe even for more like 15 years. I think that he's also referring to European and perhaps even American voices that have been criticizing the military for the coup. The Saudis are very supportive of the current Egyptian government.
Well, I recall that during the back in 2011, that King Abdullah apparently was on the phone almost every day, screaming at Barack Obama, basically saying, "Let Mubarak and his forces shoot those damn kids in Tahrir Square." Wasn't that what was going on? That the Saudis really were bitter that the United States, in their view, allowed Mubarak to fall.
Yes, they certainly were. There's no question about that.
So is it any different today? I mean, it looks as though the U.S., at least according to a front page story in Sunday's New York Times, how American hopes for a deal in Egypt were undercut. It sort of does a forensic examination of U.S. diplomacy vis-a-vis the unfolding crisis in Egypt. And it more or less paints a picture that the United States is sort of being marginalized.
Well, I think that it's important for us to recognize that what the United States was trying to do in these last couple of days was an extremely heavy lift. It was a very hard task. Because what you have right now, I think, in Egypt is a situation where the two sides, and it simplifies it to say two sides, but let's say the two sides, the military and those who back them, and the Muslim Brotherhood and those who back them, have seen themselves in a kind of an existential struggle for power, a zero-sum game. And what the United States was asking its regional allies, Qatar, the United Arab Emirates, Turkey, to a lesser extent Turkey and the Saudis, to do was to try, and what we were trying to do with the EU, was to try to get those two sides to split the difference. But in a zero-sum game, it's very difficult to persuade the participants to split the difference because they see any kind of gain for the other side as a loss and a threat to them. And I wonder how enthusiastically the Emiratis and the Saudis pushed the generals to compromise. I'm not sure that they were as enthusiastic as the EU and the U.S. was about finding some political way out of this, if a political way out was possible at all.
Well, according to this New York Times front page article that I just referred to in Sunday's New York Times, it's pretty clear that putting up $12 billion, as the Saudis, the Kuwait, and the other Gulf states did, is serious money. And there were also reports around the time of the so-called coup that nobody wants to call a coup, that the The Saudis had participated in economic sabotage in Egypt. There were no gas. There were long lines for gas. There were no food. And suddenly, the first to congratulate General Sisi were the Saudis. And suddenly, the gasoline shows up and food supplies show up. So what do you make of those earlier reports?
Well, certainly, I think that there was somebody who was choking off access to gasoline and diesel in those last couple of weeks before the coup in order to create an atmosphere of chaos. I can't imagine that it couldn't have been done without the cooperation of people in Egypt. I don't think that it was a foreign actor, Saudi or anybody else, who basically cut off gasoline to Egypt. I think that there was gasoline there, and there are people in Egypt who decided to withhold it in order to create an atmosphere of that would encourage a military coup. Now, without a doubt, once the coup happened, and there's some circumstantial evidence that the generals checked with the Gulf states, Saudi and the Emirates, before the coup to make sure that there would be support. And as you said, immediately the Gulf states backed the coup. And there's certainly no question about that. But as to who was kind of playing around in those weeks before to make the situation in Egypt worse, I think we'd have to start within Egypt itself and then go out.
So I recall that, and I'm sure we all do, that President Obama a number of years back in Cairo made a very, very groundbreaking talk where he basically tried to reorient U.S. foreign policy to be more sympathetic and understanding of Islamic movements and the general sort of democratic awakening known as the Arab Spring. And it was widely greeted as a very, very important speech that really did resonate. My sense is that what's happening today couldn't be further from what was at least not so much what was said back then by President Obama, but how it was received.
I think that's right. The United States has tried to walk a pretty fine line, particularly on Egypt, in the Arab Spring. And what it's gotten the Obama administration is the opposition and vitriol of both sides in Egypt. Because the president condemned the violence, and because when Morsi was in power, tried to have a regular relationship with the Egyptian government, those who are against the Muslim Brotherhood tend to think that the United States was supportive of the brothers. And, of course, because the U.S. wants to sustain the strategic relationship with Egypt, it didn't call a coup, as you said earlier. It didn't immediately cut off aid to Egypt after the coup. And because of that, the Muslim Brothers are looking at the United States and saying you must be supporting this coup, and all your talk about democracy is just hypocritical. So we've kind of got ourselves in a position where, because we're trying to walk this fine line, and I'm sympathetic with the administration. I think it's a really hard call, but we've kind of been neither here nor there, and have gotten both sides looking at us with suspicion.
So it does seem, though, Gregory Gores, that the U.S.'s allies in that region, principally Israel and also Saudi Arabia, although there's obviously been a great deal of ambivalence and questions about the extent to which the Saudi Arabia is duplicitous in its relationships with the United States, given their funding and backing of the Taliban and the radical groups that are destabilizing Pakistan, etc. But that's a other discussion which we could spend a day on. But for example, General Sisi apparently has got very close ties as former head of Egyptian military intelligence with the Israelis. And according to this article that I just mentioned in Sunday's front page of the New York Times, General Sisi and his circle, quoting the article, appear to be heavy communication with their Israeli colleagues. So And we've just talked about how close the King Abdullah and his public statements in support and the money in support of the Egyptian military. So it looks as if, I mean, does that strike you as a bit of an irony that we don't seem to have much sway in Cairo, but our allies, the Israelis and the Saudis, appear to have much more?
Well, I think that it's early days on that one. I distinguish between, in terms of measuring our influence, I distinguish between the kinds of things we've tried to get Egypt to do in the past, which have almost all been about Egypt's foreign policy, its relations with Israel, its relations with the Gulf states, its cooperation with the American military, its cooperation with American intelligence post 9/11. We really haven't pushed the Egyptians very much on domestic policy in the Sadat years, in the Mubarak years even, briefly under President Bush, and then we abandoned that. And what we were trying to do in the last couple of weeks is push the Egyptian military on a profoundly central issue of domestic political power. And they basically just said, no, we're not going to compromise our position as the dominant player in Egyptian politics. That's a much bigger ask than saying, would you do this with the Israelis? Would you do this in cooperation with the American military? Would you keep the Suez Canal open to our warships? That kind of thing. So I see it as a really different ask. And thus, yes, it's an indication that our influence is not paramount in Egypt, that we can't get the Egyptian military to do things that they see as fundamentally detrimental to their hold on power. But that's a really high standard for influence. But without a doubt, we tried to get the Egyptian military to hold off on this crackdown on the brothers, and they would not do it.
Well, apparently they were telling, and Hegel apparently has a good relationship with General Sisi, who...
If you count it by telephone calls, he apparently calls Sisi every day.
Right, and Sisi went to a U.S. military academy, but apparently the Egyptian generals were telling the Pentagon and the Secretary of Defense was that they refer to the Muslim Brotherhood as terrorists. The Saudi television referred to them as terrorists. The king himself, in his address on Friday, referred to them as terrorists. How can you call these people terrorists on the one hand, and as General Sisi did on Sunday, say, welcome back into the political process?
Right. I mean, I think that encapsulates it. When you've identified your enemies as terrorists, then you don't negotiate with them. And that's something that they take directly out of our playbook. And so it means that the likelihood of any kind of political process to overcome the current crisis in Egypt is, I think, very low.
And how much is this situation in terms of banishing the Brotherhood and then killing up to 1,000 or more doing this, having this month of martial law. And as I just mentioned, you know, now the general in charge is turning around and saying that he wants the Brotherhood to participate in the political process. They may well be driven underground. We had the early example of what happened to the FIS, the Islamic Salvation Front in Algeria, where they were poised to win an election and the military stepped in and annulled it, and a bloody civil war ensued in which 200,000 or 300,000 people apparently were killed. That's a terrible portent. But my sense is that in many ways, what we've done here in the West is to sort of, to prejudge Islam, to basically say, you know, essentially create our own worst nightmare here. Isn't that, I mean, if we keep saying that this is what they want, one vote, one man, one time, and aren't we making that a reality by our actions, or at least not that we're responsible entirely for what the Egyptian military are doing, but it seems to me that what you're doing here is creating your own nemesis.
Well, I think the Algeria case is instructive here, and you laid out the basics of it well. I think that that was, to some extent, if not consciously, then unconsciously, on the mind of the American government during the Arab Spring. And one of the reasons why the Obama administration said, yes, we want to deal with Islamists if they run in elections and win majorities, and we want to have normal relations with them. And I think that you can look at the Obama administration's record toward Morsi as trying to do that. But, of course, there's other interests at play for American policy in the Middle East. And when the Egyptian army refuses to deal with the fact that the Muslim Brotherhood has won the election and is going to govern, the army stirs up opposition, encourages opposition, then takes advantage of that opposition, which was real. I mean, millions of people in the streets against the Morsi government on the eve of the coup. The United States has a tough choice on its hands. If our only interest in the Middle East were the promotion of democracy, then I think, you know, our path would be clear. We would be condemning this. We would be isolating the Egyptian government and pressuring it. But we have a whole other list of interests in the Middle East that we've been talking about just in the past few minutes: the relationship with Israel, Arab-Israeli peace, oil, counterterrorism, the Syria issue, that whole range of issues. And thus, the Obama administration, and frankly, I think almost any administration, is hedging. The Obama administration is hedging. I think most other American political leaders, if they were president, would be hedging on this one, too.
Well, just in closing, though, Gregory Gores, obviously there's a danger of this becoming a self-fulfilling prophecy. We know that the Islamists feel that the West is hypocritical about democracy, and we also know that the Saudi Arabians, for all of their money and all of their talk of support against terrorism, are the most reactionary government probably on the face of the planet. It's an absolute monarchy with absolutely no vestige of democracy. So where is the positive role model there for people to follow?
That's an excellent question. I think that if you look at the Muslim Middle East right now, the only functioning democracy is Turkey. And even there, you know, there are accusations that the Islamist party that governs Turkey is trying to close off avenues of opposition for its secular opposition, avenues of political organization for its secular opposition. I don't think it's a particularly optimistic picture right now for democracy in the Arab world.
Well, Gregory Gores, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Gregory Gores, who is the department chair and professor of political science at the University of Vermont. He's the author of three books: The International Relations of the Persian Gulf, Oil Monarchies, Domestic and Security Challenges in the Arab Gulf States, and Saudi-Yemeni Relations, Domestic Structures and Foreign Influence. Previously, he was a fellow for Arab and Islamic Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the burning of the 57 Coptic Christian churches in Egypt.